fertility in the U.S. reached a new low in 2025, leading some to worry the nation could experience a baby bust. But could the nation's low birth rate be temporary? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about fertility rates and how women could be delaying pregnancy instead of ruling it out completely are University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, Dr. Emily Hurley, UC Professor of Sociology, Jeffrey Timberlake, and New York Times reporter Claire Kane Miller. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Claire, fertility in the U.S. has been declining since the Great Recession. What does the data show now?
Yeah, it started declining around 2007, which is common in recessions, but it never rebounded, which is what surprised some people. It just kept falling and falling. And each time we get a report, the latest was last month, it reached a new low.
And you reported there's evidence this could be a lull, not a baby bust. Explain that evidence. What are you talking about there?
So if you look at women in their teens, 20s, and even early 30s, they are much less likely to have a baby than they were even a decade ago. Fertility for really young women has fallen a lot, but it's increasing for older women. It's not offsetting the declines for young women because older women have fewer children. If they start later, there's just less time to do it. But there's a thought that as this generation of young women now in their 20s is delaying, that if they do end up having babies, you know, around 35 to 40, as many seem to be doing, that right now we just could be in this lull where so many people are delaying and eventually it could rebound somewhat if they start having babies later.
Claire, one of the numbers in your reporting that really stood out to me was, I think it said that most women, by the time they're, was like maybe 45, have two children. Can you talk about that? Because that really jumped out at us and seemed surprising.
Sure. So there's multiple ways that experts measure fertility. The main way that we see in the news headlines is how many babies were born to women of childbearing age this year. And that number is definitely going down. But another number, one that I find to be particularly useful, is that when women in America reach the end of their childbearing years, between 45 and 50 usually, what percent of them have had children and how many have they had? And of 45-year-olds today, almost 90% of them have had children. So the vast majority of today's 45-year-olds are mothers. Today's 30-year-olds are much less likely to have had a baby than 30-year-olds just a decade ago. But these numbers indicate that perhaps these women who are now 30 are just waiting, and that by 45, they will have caught up to where today's 45-year-olds are.
So you're saying that right now, did you say like 90% of all 45-year-olds have had children?
Almost 90% of 45-year-old women in the United States today have had children. They are mothers.
Wow. Professor Timberlake, that figure really surprised us here because, at least in our little newsroom circle, we all know lots of women in their 40s who don't have children, aren't planning to have children. So it's hard, it can feel hard to wrap our brains around this. Can you talk more about that information just from a sociological perspective?
Yeah, I mean, some of the things that Claire is talking about, I think, are mirrored in all kinds of data, not surprisingly. And, you know, the basic story, we know a lot about sort of what happened and we know much less about why it happened. But the story of declining early adult fertility among women and then an increase but not enough to offset the decrease at the early years is really what's happening. That 90% figure I had not heard before, but, you know, it is conceivable that childbearing is just being shifted from the earlier years to the later years. And what we might be seeing is this kind of temporary lull, or what demographers would call a tempo effect, where it just is happening later, but still happening, you know, to the same degree. I think, you know, there's some, of course, we don't know what will happen when 30-year-olds today reach the age of 40. Generally speaking, over the years, it has been the case that when fertility declines at earlier ages, it can't, or doesn't at least, fully pick up again in the later years. And so Probably what we're seeing in the United States is the same kind of trend as has been happening throughout the entire planet, which is that fertility overall is just declining. And even though some of it is being shifted from the earlier years to the later years, it may not ever catch up quite to the degree that the sort of declines have been happening in those earlier years.
Dr. Hurley, does that track just with the patients that you see, that, you know, 90% of women who are 45 are moms?
You know, I think we're definitely seeing a lot of patients presenting at later ages for childbearing. And there's lots of reasons that may be happening, whether they're waiting to find the right partner, you know, furthering their education and reaching their financial goals or job satisfaction before conceiving, or being financially stable. You know, I think there's lots of reasons why they're postponing. You know, I see a lot of patients that are either struggling to conceive or that are thinking about it, thinking about their future and what, and is there anything that they can do to postpone their fertility and still have a chance at conceiving later on. So I think, you know, that number is surprisingly high to me as well. But I definitely see that trend that people are postponing conception until later on.
Claire, is there something that maybe we're missing or not understanding about these numbers? You know, we've all read a lot about declining enrollment in colleges. We already have lots of women in the country who are in their 40s. So shouldn't their kids be helping to fill schools at different levels?
Sure. I mean, the declining fertility really started around 2007. And the kids, the babies born that year are just now graduating high school. And so we're just starting to see the effects. And fertility has been declining since then. We just did a story about how elementary schools are currently under-enrolled. A lot of communities are having really difficult conversations about closing schools because there are simply fewer kindergartners. And like I said, those babies who were born right when fertility started to fall are just now entering college, which is why we're also having these conversations about what's going to happen at college with these budget crunches. But this has happened before. It's happened in other countries. As one of the guests said, in Europe, it happened earlier where fertility fell and there was this lull and then it rebounded somewhat. It doesn't rebound completely if people wait that long, because if you're probably not going to have four kids if you start at 38, but it can rebound somewhat. It also happened in the United States in the 1970s when the large surge of women started going to college and entering careers that had previously been closed to them. There was a decline in fertility as they invested those early years in education and in work. And at that time, there were a ton of school closures. There were a lot of worries about a baby bust. And then they ended up having babies. And in the 80s, all of a sudden, there was all these worries about school overcrowding and where are we going to find money to build new schools for all these babies being born. So there have been times in history in our country and others where it sort of fluctuates.
Dr. Hurley, talk about some of the medical reasons that more women can wait until later in life to get pregnant and have children, and how much additional time these medical advances have kind of bought women on average.
Yeah. So what's really important for women to understand is that they're actually born with all the eggs they'll ever have. And over time, as we get older, the number of our eggs decline and the quality of our eggs decline. And so although a lot of women and patients are waiting to postpone childbearing, it is also really important to know it gets harder. It definitely gets more difficult to conceive later on. And the majority of that is caused by the declining quality of the egg. Our fertility begins to decline in our early 30s, more dramatically after the age of 37. And between the age of 40 to 45, your chance of conceiving per month's less than 5%. With high miscarriage rates and issues with and complications in pregnancy. In 2013, the process of social egg freezing or planned oocyte cryopreservation was determined non-experimental anymore. So now we can offer egg freezing to patients, you know, that want some type of extra chance at attempting conception later on in life using the eggs that they froze at an earlier age, giving themselves another chance, you know, with a better chance of success. The important thing to know about social egg freezing is it's never guaranteed. Pregnancy is never guaranteed. But that does, again, give them a chance to maybe postpone childbearing with the reassurance that they have more opportunities to try.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are other procedures, too, that women can undergo to try to increase their fertility. I know I've known plenty of women who've taken shots and tried to kind of harvest more of those eggs at once to increase their chances. Talk a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah. So when a patient presents with fertility issues or when they're trying to conceive and are having difficulties on their own, you know, they undergo a full evaluation to try to find a cause. But there are oral medications and injectable medications that we can use to try to help stimulate egg growth and ovulation, and also the process of in vitro fertilization, which is a series of injections to get a larger number of eggs to grow. And then the female undergoes a surgical procedure to remove those eggs. We fertilize the eggs in culture and then can place the embryos back inside the uterus.
Mm-hmm. We're talking in this recorded interview about declining fertility in the U.S., whether it could eventually rebound, and medical advances that give women the option to delay pregnancy. Professor Timberlake, I read a commentary that suggested a big part of why young people are waiting to have children is just anxiety about the future. What do you think this lull, if we're having a lull, says about how young women feel about their futures, the economy, the environment, all these heavy things that we're all having to deal with?
You know, it's sort of hard to believe that it's not having an effect. I mean, I mentioned a few minutes ago that, again, we have much better information about what has happened and much worse and less information about why it happened. That narrative of kind of people feeling precarious, people feeling like their housing costs are too high, they have too much student debt, they haven't found the right partner. All of those kinds of cultural and social factors almost certainly play a part in all of this. The other aspect then is that when fertility declines among a cohort, a generation of young women, then in some ways that becomes the more normative position to hold for young women. So they look around at their siblings and their neighbors and their coworkers, and no one seems to be having children when they're in their 20s. And so they don't either. So that's a sort of really hard to measure kind of ineffable cultural effect, a sort of normative effect that's sort of hard to capture. But, you know, rising costs of things, people feeling insecure about employment, people feeling insecure about the environment. I mean, all of these things surely have some effect. How much they matter and how much any one of those kind of variables, you know, is sort of explaining the decline is very, very hard to measure. Mm-hmm. So we have lots of good ideas about what might be going on, but it's very, very hard to capture the true sort of causal effect of any one of those factors.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Hurley, it sounds like you have discussions with patients about some of those concerns about, hey, can I wait because I'm uncertain about things right now? Is that right?
Absolutely. You know, and I think one of the big things that we counsel the patients on is their age, again, because age is going to be the biggest predictor of egg quality and success in the future. And I think that's the most important thing to take into account. There are some laboratory evaluations we can offer that look at ovarian reserve or how many eggs someone has left. But again, that doesn't predict the ability to conceive or the quality of the egg. But it might give them reassurance, you know, hey, you're 25, you have a large number of eggs left. You have a lot of life ahead of you. You know, maybe come back in 5 years. And if you haven't decided to conceive at that point, maybe we talk about freezing eggs or options to kind of give you an option to preserve your fertility for the future.
We'll continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, exploring Cincinnati's forgotten LGBTQ history. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our recorded conversation about fertility rates in the U.S. My guests are University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, Dr. Emily Hurley, UC Professor of Sociology, Jeffrey Timberlake, and New York Times reporter, Claire Kane Miller. Claire, I know you do so much reporting on family and gender and all these different issues that folks are dealing with. What have you been hearing from people? Have you talked to young people who are worried about starting a family or are wondering, is this the right time? Can I afford it? Those sorts of things.
Yeah, I have. And it's interesting. There's a good side to this and a not so good side to this. The good side is that women feel a choice. And in previous generations, they say they didn't necessarily feel like they had a choice. It was just the default that you become a mother. And now you have so many other options. You can get an advanced degree. you can, you know, pursue a big career. You can choose not to marry. You can choose not to have children, and that's fine. And it's not really looked down upon. It's become, you know, a norm to make that choice. So there's a lot more autonomy. And if you do start getting a big education and start earning money before you start a family, then you have, you know, money and free time. And so there, you have a lot of opportunities. You can travel, you can volunteer, you can do all these things with your time that you might not be able to do if you had kids. There's more autonomy. But on the flip side, there's also a lot more anxiety. People say they're especially worried about affordability and the cost of having kids. People buy houses, they can afford houses at a much later age now than they used to. Childcare is getting a lot more expensive, and people are aware of that. From what I've heard, these concerns about things like climate change or political polarization are often secondary concerns. They're not the main reason someone's not having kids, but if they've already decided not to, those anxieties can add on. But I think the biggest change that I've heard is that it used to be that starting a family was how you became an adult. It was sort of the first step to adulthood. People started families, they weren't that worried about money at that point because maybe they were 23, 24, and they thought they'd figure it out together. And now it's become sort of the capstone. It's the thing you wait to do until you have it figured out, until you're certain you have a long-term partner, until you have a steady job, until you feel you can afford a house. And those things are becoming harder to achieve. And so sometimes it means people are waiting a lot longer than they might have wanted to or expected to. And then they end up, you know, in their late 30s, and it's harder to become pregnant.
Claire, I know a significant part of this declining fertility rate in the U.S. is the result of fewer teen pregnancies, right?
That's right. Teen pregnancy, we had an unusually high rate of teen pregnancy in the United States. I believe it peaked in the early 90s. And it was a huge public health effort to decrease teen pregnancy. And it's widely considered to be a success. Teenagers are much less likely to have babies now. It's a result of, you know, sex ed about pregnancy prevention. It's also a result of much more access to long-acting birth control, like IUDs, and greater awareness of these things. And a lot of the demographers who I spoke with for my reporting said, the decline in teen pregnancy has really been the biggest driver, the biggest contributor to the fertility decline in the United States. And so it's important to keep in mind that that has been sort of considered a public health success. The fertility decline is not entirely something to worry about.
I was going to ask you about that, Professor Timberlake. That seems like a good thing, right, from a societal perspective, that fewer teens are having children.
Sure. And it's, you know, one of these things, too, where in the United States, because of the relatively low levels of support for mothers and for families compared to countries in, let's say, Western Europe, the teen pregnancy crisis was much more of a crisis in the United States, again, because there wasn't the same kind of social safety nets provided for people when they were young parents compared to some countries in Western Europe.
Dr. Hurley, we talked about how some women who delay pregnancy might require fertility treatments. We talked about that a little bit earlier. I know that kind of care can be expensive to receive. Is there a thought that this could become an issue of access based on women who can afford that care and women who delay pregnancy but can't afford that care?
Yeah, I think it already is an issue. There are mandated states throughout the United States that mandate fertility coverage for treatment and diagnosis. Here in Ohio, we are mandated for diagnosis, but not treatment. And it is a fight we are fighting. You're right. If you can't afford the treatments to help you conceive, you're at a disadvantage. You know, the hope is that eventually everyone will have equal access to care and equal coverage for care. You know, I always tell my patients some insurances do cover it. There are some jobs out there. There are grants available, but that doesn't cover everyone. And so I think, like I said, it's a fight we're going to continue to fight.
Professor Timberlake, we've talked about how we're seeing school enrollment shrinking in many parts of the country, school buildings closing. If we're going to see the young women of today maybe having more babies when they're in 15 or 20 years, what are the broader policy implications of that shift, of that, you know, lull and then those that fertility increasing again?
Well, to some degree, it depends on the size of the generations that we're talking about. So I think everyone, listeners, know generally that the baby boom generation, the ones born between about 1945 and 1965, that was a very big generation, meaning there were a lot of people. And so even if women of that generation had relatively fewer children, there's still more children because there's so many more mothers. My generation, Gen X, is a relatively small generation. The millennial generation, because it was born to the baby boomers primarily, that's a relatively big generation. Gen Zers, my kids, are a part of a small generation because Gen X was small and had relatively few, you know. So the whole idea is that the number of children to enter classrooms, either at the elementary school level or the high school level or college level, it depends somewhat on fertility rates of their, you know, their parents' generation, but it also depends just on the size, the number of people in that generation that produce the kids. So what we see is a little bit of a waxing and waning of the size of cohorts of school kids. Presumably, if fertility rates stay as low as they currently are, eventually it will sort of even out. The population will become more stable. And so then at least in terms of a policy, from a policy point of view, people will know, well, how many kids can we expect in any given year? But at this point, it sort of goes up and down because of the different sizes of these generations over the past, whatever, 60 years or so.
Claire, is there anything you want to add to that?
I think that sort of speaks to the idea that we could be in a lull. I don't think anyone expects fertility to go all the way back up to where the highs it was in the past, but it could be this lull. But in the meantime, you know, besides schools, things, other services close, hospitals, things that people rely on. If there are fewer kids and then eventually fewer taxpayers paying into Social Security, fewer people becoming, you know, nurses and teachers and the kind of jobs that we need, it has these long-term ramifications, which is, I think, why people start to worry about it and start to talk about how we could best support people who do want to become parents in order to be able to do so.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Professor of Sociology, Jeffrey Timberlake, UC Assistant Professor of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, Dr. Emily Hurley, and New York Times reporter Claire Kane Miller. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, exploring Greater Cincinnati's forgotten LGBTQ+ history. This is Cincinnati Edition.